stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Lucky me, Rick Moore, and lucky Emily Hayes. Thank you so much for being here, Emily Hayes, news reporter with Charlottesville Tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Emily grew up in Charlottesville, graduated from Yale in 2016. She covers growth and development and affordable living. Before writing for Charlottesville Tomorrow, she produced a podcast on education in...
And cast in Maharashtra, India, right after I graduated.
Say that city again.
It's actually a state, Maharashtra.
I'm not going to try.
It's where Mumbai is.
Mumbai. Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask you before we started how to do that, how to pronounce that, and I forgot because we were talking about so many other things that we're going to talk about here this morning.
Yeah.
I don't know India very well, obviously. I should know more. We'll have to talk about that one day. Will you come back and talk about India?
Sure.
But today we're going to talk about things in Charlottesville Tomorrow. Some of the things you've been writing about. For the radio folks is what we're going to talk about today, not just the folks who read Charlottesville Tomorrow. Let's get started right away. I want to jump in and talk about the hydraulic road and Route 29 intersection. You had an article or a little piece about this. Just a few days ago, the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Charlottesville-Albemarle Metropolitan Planning Organization has been working on this long-range transportation plan that's required for federal funding. And they're also working on a rural transportation plan that covers all of the areas outside of the sort of urban ring around Charlottesville. One of the things that transportation is one of the things that comes up a lot in my reporting. I cover mostly, new buildings going up, but transportation comes up all the time because people's first concern is usually, oh, how are we going to handle all these more people? I already experienced traffic. You know, what's it going to be like when there are 200 more people in this?
That's part of the growth.
Yeah, yeah. So these transportation plans are meant to think about that. What are the intersections that are experiencing difficulty now? It's also about, creating more sustainable alternatives to transportation for the future. Making sure that we can connect some of the bike infrastructure and the sidewalks around, trying to identify some of those spots where things are missing.
But it costs a lot of money to adjust that intersection. But it needs some serious change.
Yeah.
Especially if you've looked at it, if you've been on that road, and I would think most, if not all of the listeners have, I find it especially odd if you're trying to cross it. If it's one thing if you're just on it from Route 29 going north and south. Mm. But if you're trying to go across it, you always have that right, left. If you're on the Whole Foods side, you can't go straight across or you'd be on the other side of the road. Mm. You have to literally bend to the right a little bit to stay on your side of the median.
Mm-hmm.
But the smart scale process did not have enough money. I believe that's what they call it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the state process for roadway funding. So this was something that the Metropolitan Planning Organization applied for on behalf of both Charlottesville and Albemarle. But it was, you know, a very expensive project to try to make that intersection safer. Right now it's the most dangerous intersection, you know, really the most dangerous area in the whole area. But one of the things that Chip Boyles of the MPO was saying was that projects get really prioritized by how much matching funds, you know, how much of an investment is this? So when the state sees a huge project, like I believe there was a huge project by Hampton Roads that got tons of funding from the state because it was just a fraction of the funding they were bringing to the project. So it's a tricky thing to try to figure out, okay, Smart Scale didn't work last year. How do you, you know, reorganize the application, break it up maybe into smaller pieces so that you can get some state funding, because otherwise it's not feasible.
I also read in your article that Charlottesville Albemarle submitted 3 intersection improvement packages. Is that because there were 3 different ideas on how to do it? Or is this where they broke it down into 3 different parts and do it? We're going to do this part first and then we'll do different.
Yeah, 3 versions. But they are thinking about breaking it down into smaller parts because apparently the smaller applications do better.
I also saw where the entire area, and I didn't do the count, but there were a whole large number of roadway things that they were going to do. I mean, they wanted to do this change or improvement here and another one here, and there were a huge number of counts that wanted to be done. They were all submitted. But Charlottesville Albemarle were limited to 4 applications that could be done during this year. Why is it only 4?
Well, so it's a competitive process across the state. So the state's looking at all of these different places, you know, a small pool of money. I believe it's getting smaller. And they're trying to limit not everything will get funded.
Tell me about going to one of these meetings to do your work.
Yeah, well, there are so many meetings. I cover both Charlottesville and Albemarle, and there are, you know, I would say maybe 4 meetings a week that I'm thinking about, okay, which ones am I going to, which ones am I watching online later to try to keep track of all of the buildings going up and all the applications. You know, there are very different flavors of meetings in a way.
Flavors?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, some are very emotional. Lots of people are there. You know, the Charlottesville ones in general tend to be, especially a city council, there's a lot more attention and people are watching online and people are talking about it the next day. It's, you know, really, there's a lot of focus on it. Whereas most county meetings that I go to and a lot of other city meetings don't really have that same level of awareness and engagement from the public. So they're usually more like, okay, I have to figure out for myself what's important, what people will care about, rather than hearing it from members of the public during the meeting.
How about one of these roadway meetings, especially when somebody or I would think at least a couple people are there because they feel that Route 29 and hydraulic is important, because you said it's been one of the most dangerous interchanges in the area, and now they're being told, no, not this year.
Well,
but it can't be a very exciting meeting overall.
Yeah, well, the meeting that we're talking about happened last week on Tuesday. There was an Albemarle Planning Commission meeting, and they were just looking at these plans that have been put together by the MPO and the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. So they were just looking at the plans, and there was no one spoke during that because it was just like it's so much information. I think people didn't have something to hang on to. So that's why I put in the article, okay, so one of the top priorities is this place. Actually, during that meeting, the audience was pretty full. It was actually tons of people there, but nobody spoke about the transportation side, you know, these big transportation plans. They were focused on a particular project, this private school that's going in place somewhere, and you know, a lot of parents and students were there for that.
All right. Again, Emily Hayes is here today. She's a news reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. And we've started our conversation talking about the interchange at Hydraulic and Route 29, which at this time is not getting funding to be rearranged.
Yeah, but they're reapplying for it. So,
12 minutes after the hour. Let's talk for a minute about Charlottesville Tomorrow. Since your last visit back in February, I think, of this year, a couple new reporters.
Yeah. So we have Charlotte Woods and Billy Jean-Louis are our two new reporters that have joined us. Billy is our education reporter, and Charlotte is our government and climate reporter. Charlotte's been putting together a voter guide. You know, I heard you guys were interviewing candidates, so that's another place to look for that information all in one place. It's on our website.
Yeah, we just we're following the interview with Lloyd Snook. Jeff Leonard and Bob McAdams are doing interviews with every candidate or many of the candidates, possibly not every single candidate. Dan Gould is here with me. I'm sure he can tell me exactly who they're interviewing, but I think 13 different candidates running for office. I don't know how many, 30 different candidates or however many that Charlottesville Tomorrow may have in their voter guide.
Yeah, I've definitely lost track, but all of the primary candidates and including some, you know, state legislators are on there.
Yeah. And we'll be doing next week, Meg Hubeck from the UVA Center for Politics will also be on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, and we'll be talking about Democratic candidates running for the 2020 presidential office. So politics surrounds us here in Charlottesville. Let's move on here and talk about an article that you did recently on some apartments moving into the Pantops area. Talk about growth. 250 new apartments up onto the top of Pantops, near the Martha Jefferson Hospital.
Yeah. So
that's growth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in a way it's, you know, it's a project by Riverbend Development. They purchased that land for $5.5 million. There's been the right to do this on Pantops, do these 250 apartments since 2003. So it's really just fulfilling this component of the Martha Jefferson campus that has been seen for a while. And I think the key here is Riverbend is thinking about this as, you know, a spot for employees of the Martha Jefferson Hospital to live, or the State Farm employees to live, which is also right in that area. And, you know, I think it's really interesting. I've seen a theme a lot of can you get work and living in the same place? So then you have less transportation problems, is the idea. So that, you know, if people are just walking to work, like right across the street, then they don't need to add traffic to that very congested, you know, Free Bridge area.
Right. But is there a way for the county or the city, because the city line is not far away, to put something in the rules and guidelines to say if your traffic coming out of there crosses the air, you know, can they put some count at the light?
You know,
saying if this is what happens, then your dollar figure cost for infrastructure goes up.
Yeah, absolutely. They do have that ability to developers give proffers where they will give a certain amount. You know, there are all sorts of things that they offer, but it could be, you know, some $1 million for the county to do road infrastructure there, or, you know, they'll give up 30 feet of their land so that the road could be widened in the future. Things like that happen, you know, all the time and in every development. But something that the county has been talking about a lot lately is that there will be small developments that are, you know, really fulfilling the vision that the county has had for a long time of having higher density, more people right around the city. But these developments are, you know, maybe 40 apartments or 20 apartments, maybe an office building, that these pieces aren't large enough for the developers themselves to contribute anything. But the county is worried about, you know, what is the overall plan to accommodate this? Neighbors are always worried about that. And then, if I may add, you know, Freebridge is a really interesting example of congestion because it's really not just these developments in the Pantops area. It's the fact that many, many people working in Charlottesville don't live in Charlottesville or Albemarle. Many people live in surrounding counties and get to their workplace in Charlottesville from, very far away.
Louvanna, mm-hmm. or Lake Monticello is where they live because of the real estate cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that mm-hmm. is their point of entry
to get
to UVA or other jobs.
Exactly.
And so coming over the mountain.
Yeah. So in some ways, you know, at least theoretically, if you have more housing right next to these centers of employment, you actually cut down on that sort of thing because maybe people won't live that far out if they have an option really close. So then it seems like you will be able to cut down on a lot of that traffic.
Have you gotten any, or did you hear at the, I'm assuming that you either watched or attended the meeting that went along with that.
I saw this at a Architectural Review Board meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That's something where all the records are online of what happens in the meeting. So I cut down on the number of meetings I went to.
An Architectural Review Board meeting. Mm-hmm. Those are Architectural Review Board, and what's the one in the city called?
Board of Architectural
Board Review. Board of Architectural. Those, I'm sure we'll get to several of those later on. Those folks are known to be quite picky.
Yeah, they have specific guidelines of what kind of building goes somewhere. You know, it needs to be brick or this kind of glass.
All right, our guest today, Emily Hayes from Charlottesville Tomorrow, talking about some of the things that we've learned or we didn't learn until Emily's joined us today on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Hang tight, we shall return. And we're back here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, with our guest, Emily Hayes, news reporter, Charlottesville Tomorrow. Doing okay?
Yeah.
It is Sunday here on WPVC. Learning lots because Charlottesville Tomorrow, not a piece of paper that we can pick up. You need to go online at?
SeavilleTomorrow.org.
Not that hard to remember, everybody. Pick it up. And the news changes daily or weekly?
Yeah. We usually have 4 to 6 different articles a week between the three of us.
Because you used to have some of your articles printed at the Daily Progress, but that's no longer the case. What happened?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit, and the Daily Progress is a commercial newspaper, and you know, one of the things that people are talking about across the country is these local papers are not doing well, and the partnership in a way was to try to combat that, but we're finding that to focus on our particular mission and, you know, write to our format, that we had to sort of go our separate ways. No hard feelings. Everyone.
Well, good.
Is good with it.
Let's talk about an article that you wrote recently about the decline of neighborhood groceries. This isn't just in, I mean, this issue isn't just the Charlottesville Albemarle issue. This is really a national issue, but you're focusing your talk is about Charlottesville Albemarle. Take over the conversation.
Yeah. So this was part of a series I did with Brianna Hamblin of CBS 19. We did our reporting together about, okay, what in the Charlottesville Albemarle food system, you know, how is our food getting to us? This is a very foodie place. So it was really, really interesting to dig into that. Specifically about the groceries, this article was about how do Charlottesville residents, buy their food, and who is it affordable for? We found that one in six residents struggle to find healthy and reliable food in the area. And Chantel Bingham of the Charlottesville Food Justice Network said that this is because, you know, one of the reasons is this decline of affordable local grocery stores. At one point, this is blew my mind. In both 1916 and 1950, there were 11 black-owned grocery stores in the area. So these were local grocery stores owned by black families that had networks with black farmers in the area. And one thing that Chantel told me is that urban renewal and desegregation disrupted those networks. And actually, you saw a loss of control among people of color in this in the food economy. You know, I can't think of a single black-owned grocery store now. And we know that four used to exist in Vinegar Hill, the neighborhood that was one of the neighborhoods that was destroyed in urban renewal. And you can see, you know, very strong health disparities between black and white residents of the area. There are shorter lifespan differences. Black residents are more likely to die of diabetes. So she was pointing to this as the cause and something that they are trying to deal with on a more systematic basis than sort of providing food aid.
So today, 2019, but we can go back probably a couple decades, no urban grocery stores.
Yeah, most groceries have moved to the edges of the city, and there are a lot of different reasons for that we tried to go into in the article. We talked to Reed's Super Save Market, which is one of the last, you know, local and somewhat affordable grocery stores
right, on Preston Avenue, mm-hmm. across from the Preston Avenue Bodos, for
yeah.
those who don't know where we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I talked to Sue Clements, who's one of the owners.
Great butcher shop, for those who don't know. Several of the restaurants in the area still go there to buy their meats.
Yeah, it was really fun going there because hearing about like how they have their regular customers, even sometimes different multiple generations of a family who, you know, come for their special, you know, Thanksgiving cuts of meat or Christmas.
Yeah, I worked at a restaurant who went there to buy their some of their meats.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, continue.
Yeah. So I was asking her, you know, Brianna and I were asking her, you know, how have you survived and what are the challenges? And she said that she's been seeing competition from these large scale chains. They try to keep their prices matched. You know, Wegmans has been a big blow for them because Wegmans also has a meat, you know, special meat counter. And so some of the things that they've been focused on, you know, now they have to dig in deeper into, you know, some of the things they feel distinguishes them, like their customer service. You know, one of the days when we were there, they were having like a customer appreciation day where they're giving out free ice cream. So things like that are part of their efforts to distinguish themselves. But, you know, I asked, because this is something that the Charlottesville Food Justice Network is thinking about, you know, what would help you? Is there something that local governments could do to help, you know, promote affordable grocery stores? And so one of the things she was saying was like, don't encourage these chains, and also, you know, maybe grants. It turns out that the cost of land in Charlottesville, I mean, we all know this, is crazy expensive. So, you know, starting a small grocery store is you have to deal with this really high initial
for cost. A small family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For example, there's the Kim's Market spot on Cherry Avenue in Fifeville in Charlottesville. And Chantel said that she was part of a group that was looking at buying that land to put a co-op. And this is something the neighborhood would love. I did a series on, or a full in-depth article on Cherry Avenue and what the neighbors want. And they really want more food options right there. But, you know, I think it was something like $2 million to buy it, and that just wasn't feasible for a co-op. You know, you couldn't be a successful business after putting that kind of money in. So she was advocating for treating small grocery stores like community assets, you know. So she wants people to think of food as a human right, and that healthy food is something every neighborhood should have access to.
Again, our guest today is Emily Hayes, news reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow, talking about several of the articles that she has written. She writes a piece on a weekly basis called Development Digest, a roundup of some of the most significant buildings being planned, and some more in-depth articles as well. Currently, we're doing one of the roundups on some of these, including an article on the decline of neighborhood groceries, 29 minutes after the hour. One of the other issues, not just the cost of land, but you mentioned transportation as a barrier for people.
Yeah. So I talked to these two lovely sisters, Monique and Heather Nevins, who live in the Woolen Mills area. They really struggle with transportation. So they're on Social Security, so they have a super limited income. You know, it's like they didn't want me to say an exact number, but I've talked to a lot of different people on Social Security, and it can be, you know, like $700 a month, and that barely covers rent. Or if you can find rent that good, that's impressive. So then they're piecing together all of these, you know, health-related taxis or local transit options, and there's nothing within walking distance for them. Monique used to live in Scottsville, right across from, you know, she could walk and get so easily to all of the different food options. She was right across from the library, which meant a lot to her. So that just sort of emphasized for me the difference, you know, how dependent you are when this stuff isn't in walking distance.
Has there been discussion at any of the meetings that you've been to, the county, or I guess in this case we're talking about the city meetings for the most part, about assisting the more urban convenience stores to help them with fresh foods, or to assist a family in opening one of these more fresh food markets in the areas that we're talking about?
Yeah, the city has contributed money to the Charlottesville Food Justice Network. And one of the things that CFJN is bringing back is sort of a comprehensive plan chapter just about food that, that would give a vision of like what would the city need to do to think of food like a human right and make sure that everybody has access. There's a lot of engage, you know, it's almost like a almost full-time organizing job where Chantel is going to all of these low-income communities and asking what they want and what they need and how they would like to restructure their future. And so she's trying to put all of that together, you know, with the backing of all the other members of the Food Justice Network, a lot of nonprofits. So the end point is to try to figure out, does the city need to do something like that, you know, provide grants or something like that?
Again, Emily Hayes here from Charlottesville Tomorrow. Let's move on to a couple other articles that have been written. Let's talk about the petition for the closing of 4th Street on the downtown mall. The downtown mall, 4th Street, mm-hmm. where...
Yeah, so this is where, you know, on August 12th, 2017, a white supremacist drove his car into protesters on the downtown mall, and activist Heather Heyer was killed, and a lot of other people were injured. So the petition came out around the second anniversary of August 12th, and but the petition was really primarily focused on pedestrian safety. So this was a petition started by resident Eileen Bartels. She was arguing this crossing did not always exist. It was open in 2006 and that it endangers pedestrians. By a few days after the anniversary, 357 people had signed this petition online. It was generating a lot of buzz. The Downtown Business Association of Charlottesville is very opposed to the idea of crossing, though. They say that, you know, it's created a huge difference in sales. You know, even individual business owners who were on the pedestrian mall itself and moved to the crossing found, you know, one said that her sales had something like doubled, and that it's a necessary part of successful pedestrian malls everywhere. They did their own petition and got something like 352 signatures online and more on paper, they said. Seville Weekly did a nice little follow-up about this that you can see, too. And they found, Seville Weekly found, that there were no pedestrian injuries except for August 12th. So it might contribute to pedestrians feeling unsafe, but that hasn't really panned out in the years since it's opened. Another interesting aspect of this story is that Ms. Bartels took down her petition after DBAC's opposition and said she felt, you know, threatened that she didn't want to engage in this environment, and she closed her Twitter account as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So, hot button topic that... You know, I haven't. At least one city councilor, Councilor Wes Bellamy, is for closing the crossing. That's what he said so far. Because you know, it's where this, you know, Heather Heyer died. It means a lot to people. I haven't heard other councilors necessarily supporting closing it, so I'm not sure if it's going to go anywhere.
So, the woman who put the petition up, what was her name again?
Eileen Bartels.
And she has taken it down because she felt threatened?
Yeah. I forget the exact words, but she, there was so much opposition and sort of, I guess, sort of personal attacks of why she, of her putting this up, that she decided, you know, to take it down and that it wasn't worth engaging in this debate. Something I'm sure many of us feel online.
Right.
It's not always the nicest place out there.
All right. Um, 37 minutes after the hour. We're going to take our break a minute or so early so we can come back and go through the next article without being disrupted. Our guest today, Emily Hay, she's a news reporter from Charlottesville Tomorrow, where we are going to discuss land use and planning, some of her specialties, where she puts out the Development Digest and occasionally does some deeper articles. And we're going to come back and talk about a piece on restaurant workers and how they face low wages and insecurity. So hang tight, and we're going to take a break right now. All right? Here we are back with Emily Hayes. Emily, so we were talking about food earlier, about the groceries, but you also did a piece on restaurant workers. I think the title is Restaurant Workers Face Low Wages and Food Insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a chef mm-hmm. working to change that.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to go into one of the interviews I did was with Ryan East, who started professionally cooking, a year or two ago. And he wasn't eating healthy food while he was doing that. You know, he's making other people's, you know, dinners and making their days. But with the high staff turnover and long hours and minimal meal allowance that he said he experienced at this first job, all he was doing was kind of snacking on chicken tenders and fries as he was making them for other people, you know, testing whether the taste was right, that sort of thing. On average, across the area, the average wage is $10.25 an hour. It's difficult to cover necessities in this area on that wage. And so Chef Antoine Brinson has started this culinary concepts, also often called a boot camp, with the city's economic development department. And the goal is to get people into a career that will have a trajectory where, you know, maybe someday they could become the top chef at this restaurant. And he sees this as, you know, a big benefit for the restaurants as well, because, you know, then they don't have to deal with turnover all the time. If they really invest and mentor their employees, then they will, you know, the vision and creativity they can unlock in these employees is much greater. So he has something like, he has 58 partners in the area, including some like Harvest Moon Catering and Farmington Country Club. And he and the city place people in where they know that they will have a higher starting salary that's, you know, a little bit more sustainable, and then also growth from there.
What does he call this?
Culinary concepts.
Does it cost them anything?
No. So students, the city pays for student tuition. You know, it's like a part-time job, so they might experience, you know, some, they might have to cut back on their hours or something on their other job, but, you know, it's 5 weeks and so far they've had amazing success. I think they're in the fifth cohort, and except for two people who had sort of more personal reasons that they didn't want to move forward with cooking after all, they've gotten better jobs after the boot camp.
Do you know where the city is getting its funding?
Okay. I did remember, I did look into this. It comes, I believe this comes from the Economic Development Authority, and it's a little complicated how those get their funding, but sometimes they have their own revenue streams and sometimes they get it from the city. So in other words, it's the city's paying for it either through these revenue streams from the Economic Development Authority or from the city's budget.
Okay. So they already have some pool of money, and this is just like, oh, well, we're just going to use it over here mm-hmm. rather than over here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, something that I think is pretty interesting is that a lot of economic development departments, you know, you see them doing things like trying to get large employers to their region to help with revenues. Then you don't have to tax residents as much. But the city is also has this focus on developing careers for low-income people in the city, and sees that as part of economic development as well.
Did you get a chance to interview Mr. Brinson?
Yeah. He's very excited about this program, clearly loves what he's doing. He, you know, expanding into an online format as well, so he can reach more people. He's a mentor individually to all of the people who have gone through his boot camp. It's kind of crazy. I don't know how he does it. Yeah.
Has he, I'm just curious about whether is he out there picking people that he thinks will be successful, or does he just put his sign up saying, hey, we're over here if you want to come join us.
Right.
And then has people come in the door and he puts his arm around them and say, come on, we can turn you into a successful person.
Right. So I think he did a lot of initial outreach into neighborhoods, knocking on people's doors and things like that. But as people have gone through the program, the word has kind of spread on its own. And so people sometimes hear about it from a friend who did it, and that's why they're applying, and they get a lot of applications and then narrow it down from there.
Again, the restaurant workers face low wages and food insecurity. How much of an urban group is this who might also be dealing with the poor grocery stores?
Yeah.
Do these overlay at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think the sort of range of incomes, a lot of the people experiencing, you know, how the housing shortage most severely, a lot of people experiencing the lack of grocery stores, it's all overlapping, and they're usually making, they almost all of this group has, they have jobs, they just aren't paying enough. I think there was to make enough to afford the average rent in the city, you have to have 3 minimum wage jobs, full time. It's just not possible.
Right.
Yeah, they definitely are overlapping communities.
Again, Emily Hayes with us today from Charlottesville Tomorrow, where she is a reporter doing a lot of work on land use and planning, telling us about some of the articles and stories that she has written in the past. 45 minutes after the hour. Mr. Brinson sounds like he'd be a great person to bring on the show.
Yes, definitely.
Hopefully you can help us out there. We're always looking for interesting personalities with great pieces. You've also written about a couple places that are being developed. Everybody knows the phrase, the Belmont Bridge design. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so we're really nearing the final steps of this very long process to replace the Belmont Bridge, which, caught the city's attention in 2003 as being, you know, deteriorating and not in a condition where it could, you know, they're worried about this bridge not being, you know, having rust and stuff like that. So that started in 2003. There was a business that was taking care of the design, but that went under. There was some initial public opposition to the initial designs. But finally, all these years later, you know, funding is secure. The design was approved by city council last year. And then the BAR has done its own. This is the Board of Architectural Review we were talking about earlier.
Those picky, picky people.
Yeah, they have done their own approval of the design as well. So now the only things are left are some steps of, you know, acquiring right of way to do everything that they've put in the design, and building it, and construction's projected to start next year.
Ken, when the phrase design finalized is said, is that, can that be accepted and believed?
Yeah, 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 this is it. I mean, yeah, I don't see a, and something unless something unforeseen happens, the design is done. This is it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so now, when will the bridge construction begin?
Next year.
Next year, mm-hmm. 2020. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the spring, the summer, or the fall?
I forget, but it's, you can see it online. There's a very handy website that's Belmont. You know, just if you search Belmont Bridge, it's one of the first things that come up that okay. has all the updates.
And is there an idea on the length of time that it will take?
Yeah, it's supposed to be complete by 2022. Yes.
Okay. And during that time frame, can people who typically travel over it, will you still be able to travel over it, or will you have to go find some other path completely?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, there will probably be different phases, but again, I think this is something where you should go to the website for the details of how this is planned.
All right. But the Belmont Bridge design has been finalized from 2003 to 2019. Let's talk about some West Main Street and Downtown Mall land use and planning. So 600 West Main Street,
mm-hmm.
Something where a lot of people now who've been in Charlottesville or travel that area, University Tire and Auto Center. It's where that is now.
So 600 West Main is under construction now, next to the University Tire and Auto Center. They've put in an application now to tear down the Auto Center and put a partner building right next to it, the second phase of 600 West Main. And that's going to be shorter than the one that's already nearly complete. It's four stories. The plan is 55 apartments. And with a ground floor of commercial. And it's been to the Planning Commission once, and they wanted to get some more details, so they're coming back on September 10th. That's this Tuesday. It's also very close to the First Baptist Church, so that community is watching the development very carefully, making sure, you know, they'll still be able to use their alleyway that's kind of shared between the two buildings, and you know, they're watching as well to see how it's going to change the look of the street.
Right, and I would think that they're also, I mean, that church must have some historic.
Oh, yes.
Aspects
oh,
in terms yes. of, I mean, not just important mm-hmm. to the people who attend the church, but the building itself, I would think, has some historic aspects architecturally. And so there must be concerns there.
Yeah. This building was built by, you know, people who were enslaved before the Civil War, you know, something like 10 years after the war ended, they were working on their extra hours to literally build this church. There's some really like beautiful descriptions of it in some books of local history. So yeah, oldest Black church in the area.
And so do you get folks, churchgoers who attend these meetings, are they okay with the work at the Tire and Auto Center being done, and all they're saying is be careful? Or are they going, don't you dare do anything because you're going to hurt our church?
Well, the last meeting, the reason why it got deferred is, you know, one of the members of the church was like, what's happening during construction? How will that affect our building? You know, could it destabilize our building? And so they spent a lot of time during the meeting trying to figure out how could the city regulate that to make sure that the developer doesn't hurt the building next door, you know, that there aren't any cracks that happen when they're doing the work on the second phase of 600 West Main. The developer said, you know, he felt very confident that they knew how to do this because 600 West Main is actually built around, you know, the Blue Moon Diner building. The Board of Architectural Review decided that that building was so important that the developer couldn't knock it down. So that building is still standing and fine, and that was part of how the developer had to build. So he felt confident that, you know, he could do all of the best practices to avoid anything happening to the church.
What's happening? What is happening with all the parking and the driving and all the car usage, et cetera, for West Main and what's the neighborhood there? Star Hill and mm-hmm. Fifeville, et cetera, mm-hmm. with all this. And here's another. You said this new building would have 55.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the idea.
What is the city and the Board of Architectural Review saying about that?
Yeah. So the developer has planned to put parking underneath the building. So you would.
No wonder the church is questioning what's going on.
Well, that's one of the things that urban planners see as, like, you know, the best practice for you know, a kind of urban landscape. But the neighborhood is worried. You know, they already have a lot of employees from UVA parking in their neighborhood, or people, you know, parking in their spots and then going to the Amtrak station that's right there and leaving their cars over the weekend. And the neighbors are like, that's my spot. Like, what are you? So the developer, you know, has planned for the parking arrangements for the residents, you know, what he sees as necessary for the market and even more really than that. Another aspect of this is that this is another building that is in walking distance from the big employment centers in the area, the University of Virginia and the downtown mall. So he also says, you know, there's going to be bike racks and stuff like that, and people will be able to bike or walk to these areas. So he's saying they won't even need cards.
Okay. No cars needed.
Yeah, neighbors never really buy that, but.
All right. So let's talk about another new building, the Artful Lodger space near the Omni. We got a few minutes left. Near the Omni at the downtown mall.
Yeah, this was one of the stories that I was most proud of breaking because this is, you know, classic, something that people get really excited about because 9 stories on the downtown mall, you know, everyone knows where that is. The idea would be 134 apartments. It would be where the Artful Lodger building is now, right as East Market Street goes into West Market Street and then Preston Avenue. And it would be within walking distance of the building that's now under construction at the end of the downtown mall, the Center of Developing Entrepreneurs. And that's where the Charlottesville ice
skating rink.
Yeah, exactly, where that used to be. So this is the same developer as 600 West Main Heirloom Development. And that is supposed to be at a meeting, a public meeting in the city on September 24th.
Now, I noticed in your article that one of the amenities is it is supposed to have a green roof.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the Artful Lodger building coming down? Is it just not big enough? I mean, here's somebody else who says not enough space, need more apartments and more retail space here.
Mm-hmm.
Could do more with what we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that this is right across from the code building is some answer to that question. There is so much demand to work in Charlottesville, and so the housing hasn't kept pace with that demand. So the idea with the developers have is put the housing where the business.
All right, is. Just got a minute left. How'd you break the story?
I have good relationships with city staff.
So it's who you know?
It's all about source development.
It wasn't that you walked into the room or somebody told you something that you shouldn't know or found a piece of paper laying on the floor?
Right. I mean, it was all already public record, but yeah, it was about telling me where to look.
Oh, okay. Again, Emily Hayes, she's a news reporter with Charlottesville Tomorrow, and you've got a couple new reporters, and so people don't have to spread themselves so thin as they've been doing. Will you come back?
Yeah, or maybe one of these excellent new reporters could also come back.
Again, next week we'll have Meg Hubeck from the UVA Center for Politics, and we'll do our own politics here as we get ready for election time. But we'll be doing 2020 politics. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This is fun.
All right. Take care, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.